I pass to the main talk this evening. It's going to be given by Mr. Colin McCarthy, who we've met before on this platform. He comes originally from Australia. He's an electronics engineer and has worked at one time on the space program, the American space program, with NASA. He was in at the start of UFO research in Australia in 1954, and so has considerable experience of ufology in that area of the world. The subject to his talk tonight is the UFO in Australia. Mr. McCarthy.
Thank you. I'd like to start by wishing everybody a happy new year. And you forgive me if I sit down, but I've got a bad back. And yes. Well, now I'd like to start by telling you something about the early days of ufology in Australia. And when I say early days, it's not all that early, really. But it really begins in 1954. And a gentleman in Sydney called Mr. Edgar Jarrold was really the beginner of the story in Australia. And we have with us tonight Mr. Andrew Thomas, who will, after the coffee break, be giving us a short little talk. And he was with Mr. Thomas from the very, with Mr. Jarrold from the very beginning. And I have here a very historical document, going slightly yellow with age. It's the original little newspaper put out in 1954-55 by Mr. Jarrold and Mr. Thomas. It was called the Australian Flying Saucer Magazine. And it did run for a reasonable time and really was full of interesting news. But unfortunately, Mr. Jarrold decided to give up ufology and the magazine became defunct. I'd like to now switch to South Australia, where I carried out most of the research. At the time I'm speaking, 54-55, Australia was, being a large place, was sort of split in the UFO field. There was some activity going on, a lot of activity going on in Adelaide, South Australia, a little in Perth, and just a trace in Melbourne. Now, for some reason, Adelaide became the centre for about 5 years of really concentrated ufology. And I'd just like to mention several things that happened in the early days. And one of them concerns a Mr. Keith Cartwright. Now, there's been lots of talk lately about UFO detectors, and you may have noticed that I brought one along, an electronic one, a prototype, a few weeks ago. Well, Mr. Keith Cartwright, in 1955, as far as we know, was the first person to build a magnetic compass type of detector. And he is resident in Adelaide, South Australia. He received a great deal of publicity throughout the world, and he had interviews on radio, in the papers, and as you can imagine, in those days, especially in a backwater like Australia, it created quite a flap. But like lots of things in Australia, where there's a strong sun shining overhead and plenty of beer in the pubs, it sort of all died a natural death. And the society there sort of went underground, almost underground anyway, after the initial flap. Now, I'd like to tell you something about this detector and what happened, because it's a most interesting story. Now, Mr. Cartwright is a very hard-headed businessman who runs a real estate agency. And as you possibly know, there's no one really more hard-headed than a real estate agent. And he was interested in ufology for some time prior to the beginnings of the society, which was actually founded in South Australia by a Mr. Fred Stone. Possibly some of you have heard of him. Now, Keith thought about the problem. He was in the Air Force as a navigator, and also he'd study engineering. One night, he was sitting down quite quietly in his home after a hard day's work, And suddenly he said, into his mind, as it were, now he wasn't one to believe in mental telepathy or anything like this, a complete plan appeared of a simple UFO detector. It consisted of a compass needle and a contact, a buzzer, and later on a relay, which he added actually to improve the thing. Now, he wondered where this came from. He said it was just appeared in his brain, as it were, like a mental picture. So he thought, well, this is too good to be true. I'll build it, see what happens. So he did build it, and he tried a few prototypes, and eventually settled on a fairly advanced model of this type, where he actually silver-plated contacts and used a contact ring so that the compass needle fitted tightly in this ring, so no matter whether it had a vertical or a horizontal component change, it would touch a contact, operate a relay which would ring a bell. And at the same time, he was told that this device would work if he was to set this up very quickly, as quickly as he could. Within the next few weeks, he would have proof that it would work. Now, I must stress again that Mr. Cartwright is not one to go into fancies of mental telepathy and such things. So this makes the story even more interesting. So he set the detector up and got in touch with me. And myself and another early researcher, Mr. Peter Thomas, who was an electronics engineer as well, we all gathered around, very sceptically, of course, to see this great UFO detector. And I must say, when we first saw it, it looked slightly laughable. But never mind, I'm afraid we were the ones to be sneered at later on for our derision. Now, one evening, back in 1955, it was raining. Now, a very significant thing, this rain. It was unlike the rain here in England. In Australia, when it rains, it really rains. You get subtropical downpours. You might get 5 inches in an hour. Well, this night it was just drizzling, which is fairly unusual. And it was in the middle of winter. And when I say winter, the temperature was about 65. It's about as cold as it gets. And we were all sitting around the table discussing different aspects of ufology, discussing George Adamski and his claims and such forth, when suddenly the detector went off. The exact second the detector went off, the rain over the house suddenly teemed for about 5 seconds. It literally poured. And then suddenly it stopped and went back to a drizzle again. Now I thought, coincidence. Fair enough. So we let that one pass, as obviously you couldn't see anything outside because of the low cloud base. The very next night, again it was raining. It was part of a rain pattern that lasted about a week. The same thing happened, almost at the same time. It was about 9:30 in the evening. The detector went off again, and again the rain suddenly increased terrifically, as if someone had suddenly emptied a bucket over the house, and then it died away. And we noticed that as it died away, the detector stopped working. Now, we got in touch with some chaps who were in the UFO group at the time, Mr. Fred Stone's group, who collect information about contact, UFOs in the sky, like newspaper cuttings and such like. And we learned that that evening, in the country, a large disc-shaped object had been seen by 3 separate people. And plotting the course, it would have passed directly over the suburb of Adelaide, where we were. Again, this is only circumstantial, but very interesting all the same, I think you'll agree. Now, we've got all sorts of wonderful theories as to how this could happen, how the rain could increase, why the rain increased. One theory is that if the UFO was travelling very close to the cloud layer, cloud base, in clear air above, and in fact, it was had a fairly large mass, and if the actual anti-grav drive unit was producing a large force field, as it would do, perhaps the downward thrust to equal the levitating upward thrust of the craft to make it hover and travel forward, might have been acting on the rain particles or the dust particles in the cloud and causing condensation to increase. Purely a theory. We don't know. But it was too much of a coincidence for it to happen two nights running. The next thing that happened is that about a week later, Mr. Cartwright was sitting quietly again in his house, and suddenly he got in his mind's eye again a complete colour picture. He said it was just as if someone had shone a slide on the wall, and it showed he was looking actually slightly from a slightly downward angle at a UFO that was hovering over the sea. It was in brilliant sunshine, and this was at night, remember, but this UFO was in brilliant sunshine, and there was a chap standing on the outer rim, and he was feeding a long cable into the sea. And he looked up, now this is strange to say, but Keith Cartwright said he looked up and looked at me as if he was aware that I was looking at him. And mind you, Keith hadn't been drinking, and he wasn't asleep. And he said this chap was dressed in a one-piece garment of the usual type we've known about now for some time, and did have long blonde hair. So Keith immediately thought, hello, it's wishful thinking. I'm getting George Adamski type people. And then he got a mental impression that this place was Papua New Guinea. Now, this is very significant. Remember this, because later on I'll tell you about the Father Gill case, which I think a lot of you know already, and this took place in this area about 4 years later. And this chap gave him the impression that he was taking a temperature reading of the ocean in the tropics. And then Keith suddenly became conscious of the fact that this very UFO would be passing over the Adelaide Hills. There's the hills at the back of the city of Adelaide. They rise to about 2,500 feet. And that there was a little gully called Carey's Gully, situated sort of in the back of these hills. And that he got the impression that if he was to go to this particular place 3 days from that date, this craft would be passing over. Now, it was stressed to him in this sort of mental contact, if you like, that in no way were they doing this to oblige him. It had just happened that they were doing research along a fault line that exists through the Adelaide Hills, and that if he happened to be there at the right time, he would see them. So we thought, oh, this is something. So we all trooped out and went into the Adelaide Hills. And we had a picnic at Carey's Gully. And as usual, the Australian keg was present. Keg, by the way, full of beer. But this didn't sort of make us see things in the sky. And about 5 o'clock, we decided to give it away, that obviously nothing was going to happen. So we left Carey's Gully, we came home. I'll never forget the look on my face, I suppose, if someone else would see it. The next morning, when I opened the paper, and a farmer in Carey's Gully had reported that at 5:15 that very night, an unidentified flying disc had flown low over his farm, hovered for a few seconds over the outer paddock, the very paddock in which we were camping, and then it disappeared. So we missed it by 15 minutes. Now that's possibly one of the most significant cases I know where an apparent mental contact has agreed with a physical sighting. But again, circumstantial. Now, another very interesting case of UFOs magnetically affecting equipment took place again in South Australia in 1955. And this took place between two telephone exchanges. Now, at the time, I was finishing off my diploma course with the Adelaide University, and as part of our training in the communication section, we were allocated to various telephone exchanges for a short period of time. And I was situated at that time at at the Woodville Telephone Exchange. And this was in the evening at about 7:30 p.m. Suddenly, all the equipment stopped functioning. Now, for this to happen in a telephone exchange is most remarkable. The fluorescent lights dipped for a fraction of a second, came back on again, but every single piece of equipment in the exchange dropped out. Now, I might explain here that the switches that operate in the telephone exchange are magnetically operated, electromagnetically operated. Every single switch of every call that was being progressed through that exchange at that instant stopped. Now, this only happened for about 5 seconds. And when the switches drop out, they stay dropped out until the subscriber calls again. Well, of course, everybody started to call at once. As soon as their call dropped out, they started to redial. And then again, all the calls progressed normally. But the fact was noted in the log of the exchange as being unexplained. Now, it couldn't have been a power failure because the telephone exchange receives its power for the all the switching from batteries, wet cell batteries. So it's completely independent of the mains. Now, they received notification about a half an hour later. The North Adelaide telephone exchange, which is junctioned with the Woodville exchange, rang up the supervisor and said, "We've just had a very funny thing about half an hour ago." He said, "All our switches dropped out. Have you any explanation?" And he said, "Well, that's funny, all our switches have dropped out too." And so they got their heads together and came up with a big fat zero, of course, and the whole matter was conveniently forgotten. But I took note of the time in the log, and then as a thought hit me, and I plotted on a map, took a line between the two telephone exchanges. Now, it's interesting to note that the time between the two dropouts was about 30 seconds. Extrapolating forward, knowing the distance between the two telephone exchanges and the time between the dropouts, plus or minus, say, 10%, because they keep a fairly accurate log, by going back along that line, I found it intersected the city of Melbourne, some 500 miles to the east. The very next day, a report appeared in the Melbourne press about a flying poached egg, of all things, that had been seen going over Melbourne that night. And it fitted perfectly. If you took the time that the object was seen over Melbourne on its course, it was plotted on a course from different observers of the flying saucer group in Melbourne, the exact speed it was doing, it would have agreed exactly with my figures as it going over those two telephone exchanges. So here again we have another example of the extremely strong magnetic field of the craft temporarily affecting the switches in the telephone exchange. Just how it caused the complete electromagnetic dropout, I don't really know. But it certainly did. Now, we progress from flying poached eggs to some early investigations of landings. This is mainly what I specialised in Australia, and as you no doubt know, Australia's had a great deal of landings, I think for the simple reason that it's less populated than here. I don't know whether you are aware that the total population of Australia is now just equal to the population of Greater London. 11.5 million people, so since they extended the boundaries of London. And that 11.5 million people are scattered over a continent, an island continent the size of the United States. So, you can see that there are vast tracts of land where nobody lives, and in some cases nothing lives. For instance, in the Northern Territory of Australia, you could fit the British Isles three times into the Northern Territory. It has a total population of 110,000 people. Half of it's tropical, half of it's desert. Well, the very first, one of the two interesting cases of landings took place in a fruit growing area outside of Adelaide in 1958-59, around January 59, actually, I think it was. And two fruit growing farmers, were on their way at about 4 o'clock in the morning to Manham, a small town where they were to sell their produce to the market. And they topped a rise and they said suddenly in a field in front of them, they saw a great, what they thought was a circus tent with rotating lights on it, red and green lights. And they thought, what in the devil is a circus tent doing in the middle of the field at 4 a.m. in the morning? So they, as they sort of went to go up towards it, the engine of their truck stopped. Now this seems to be a very common thing, as you probably know, with UFO phenomena. And one of the chaps suddenly got scared, and he said, I had the funny feeling that something was watching me. Now, I don't know why, so I hadn't at that time thought the thing was anything unusual, but there was something alien, he said later, watching him. Well, they got out of the truck and they started to walk towards the object. Now, we investigated the field with a theodolite, Geiger counters and what have you, and the object was about 150 feet in diameter, it turned out, and it did in fact leave a depression in the ground at one point, around the centre, as if it was resting on some centre pillar. As they approached, they said they heard a very slight whirring sound, and the red lights rotated one way, and the green lights rotated another, and the craft lifted into the air, quite silently, except for this very faint hum, tipped to an angle of about 45 degrees, and then swayed with a leaf-type motion. This again is significant. Lots of UFO reports report this fact of a swaying. And suddenly shot into the sky, disappearing over the nearby hills. They, of course, ran like hell for their car and took off. Being fairly simple folk, and they blurted out their story. It appeared in the papers, and then it was discovered that the people of Manham had seen the object hovering over their town about an hour later. And that object appeared for the next fortnight, every night without fail, over that town. At one stage it swooped quite low over the same field as the farmers, with the same field the farmers saw it. Completely unexplained phenomenon. Now, at the same time, to get collaboration between stories, to really make it interesting, a young cinematograph operator from Port Elliot, which is a seaside town of South Australia, about 50 miles from the city of Adelaide, was coming home one night after the finishing of the cinema, and he reported seeing an object on the ground that looked like a circus tent, and he gave exactly the same description, even to the same humming noise, even to the same falling leaf motion. Now, I might tell you now that this chap's report came out before the big flap in the papers about the original one, so there could have been no collaboration between the two. And again, there was flattened area of grass where the object had been resting. He thinks he saw a shadowy figure near the object, but this is purely circumstantial again, and he doesn't really know. There were no footprints. Now we come to a very interesting case, and this involves official silence from the security. At this time, I was engaged at the Weapons Research Establishment in Salisbury, South Australia, and at Woomera. So I know a bit about security. In fact, at times it was so bad you almost had to have a security officer go with you when you went to the toilet. But, in some places. Now, some three young lads were travelling back across the Nullarbor Plains. Now, possibly you've heard of the Nullarbor Plains. They extend for about 1,000 miles and they're literally without trees. Nullarbor. No trees, from the Latin. And they were approaching the South Australian border across this flat desert-type road when an object appeared off their right-hand side of their car. and it swooped in low, and it commenced to fly in ever-decreasing circles. Reminds me of a story. No. Slowly coming closer to this particular motor car. They, of course, stopped in amazement. And luckily, they were great keen photographers. They had 35mm reflex cameras fitted with telephoto lenses. They had 8mm movie cameras, and one chap even had a 16mm movie camera loaded with colour film. So they had a grand time. They filmed and they filmed and they filmed. And this object, almost as if it wanted to be filmed, because it came closer and closer, that it would hover while they took their shots, that it would swing around the other side of the car, do all sorts of manoeuvres for the movie film. And 3 hours. I know it sounds strange, but 3 hours this went on for. And they said they definitely saw figures looking through the portholes. It was a real Adamski-type UFO. But they said they had the distinct impression these characters were playing a game with them. Because as they'd swoop in low, that they'd see this chap lean out and smile at them, and a couple of times they waved. And they noticed too that as the craft swooped in low, it kicked up a great deal of dust in a whirling motion below the craft. It's almost as if the anti-grav unit or drive, whatever drives them, was causing the dust to whirl. Could have been a jet, of course. Although they said they heard no sound. I'm sure they should have heard the chap laughing inside. Yeah, there you are. Anyway, I'm sure this was authentic, because I know one of these chaps, and I know that they wouldn't make up a story like this. But then they made a fatal mistake. After the craft had gone, they were so excited, as you can imagine, that they all... When they got to the first town in South Australia, which is a little one-horse town, you know, one horse and half an aborigine, they rang the police. And the police, in a typical outback fashion, said, "Well, perhaps you'd better put more water with it, cover, you know." And said, "Oh, well," he said, "we don't handle this." He said, "We don't handle this sort of phenomena." He said, "But I tell you who does, up there at Woomera, they know all about this. Probably one of theirs." So this policeman rang the security at Woomera, a very fatal mistake. Woomera immediately dispatched by phone to the policeman to try and hold these characters in this town, but as it was too late, they'd already left. They were determined to get back to the nearest processing department and have their films processed as soon as possible, I suppose. But they'd gone about, I suppose, another 100 miles when an army helicopter landed in front of their car. Security men got out, confiscated every single camera and every single piece of equipment they possessed, and told them that if they were to dare say one word about the whole affair, the Official Secrets Act would be flung at them. Because they were near Woomera. They were actually, the security men told them a slight lie. They said, "You are in fact inside the boundary of the Woomera rocket range, therefore you are under the Official Secrets Act." Turned out later they weren't actually. Now, about 3 months after this, after much connivering on both sides and having a few inside contacts, they managed to get back one photograph. That's all. Out of all those hundreds they've taken, they got one photograph back, which showed a rather blurred... It was one of the very first where the object was approaching at high speed, and of course it was horribly blurred and wasn't very significant. As far as I know, all the rest of those photographs went into the UFO file that exists in Salisbury. This file, it covers about 3 big filing cabinets you couldn't jump over. And while I'm on this thing, Woomera itself has had UFOs. A Kinney Theodolite, which is a high-speed camera photographing the launching of a certain missile, which I can't name. The missile was climbing at full thrust, shall we say in excess of 1,500 miles per hour, when a disc-shaped object came literally screaming out of the sky, described three beautiful circles around the while this missile was climbing at 1500 plus, sort of dipped itself in salute and took off. The radar tracked it, the kinetheodolites tracked it, it was filmed on high-speed 35mm film. I have seen the film, and there's no doubt that you can see a disc-shaped object appearing, travelling around the missile and heading off. But this film has never been released, and probably never will be. The one that was told about in the papers, a great cigar-shaped object, sort of one evening conveniently hovered above Woomera, flashed lights at the place in contempt, stood on its end and took off straight up. Woomera authorities announced to the press that the planet Jupiter had been doing gyrations that evening. The less said that about the better. I have some yes, I'm tongue-tied. I'm flabbergasted, as someone once said. Now, the next thing we come to in this sort of run around the UFOs in Australia is the visit of George Adamski to Australia in 1959. Well, George arrived, and he really did arrive. I'll tell you one amusing incident which happened. At this time, Mr. Fred Stone, unfortunately, had gone a little bit astray in his UFO research, and had gone slightly leaning, well, more than slightly this time, towards the religious side of matters, and had actually founded a religious society based on ufology, which was very unfortunate. So a separate organisation was founded in South Australia, which has now become, the present organisation as we know it. And this society, of course, couldn't literally get a look in with George because it happened that Mr. Fred Stone had invited George over before the breakup occurred. So several of us in a group of people, mainly scientific eggheads, not me, although I'm going that way, decided to kidnap George. We must have a talk to George at any cost. So we thought we'd kidnap him. We did. So we contacted him. Fortunately, Keith Cartwright knew the manager of the hotel where George was staying, and we smuggled somebody in there. That somebody being me. And I managed to get in to see George, and he thought it was a great idea, because he had a wonderful sense of humour, you know. Contrary to what other people say about him, he did have a wonderful sense. He thought this was a wonderful idea. And so we decided to kidnap him. So we made arrangements. 7 o'clock one evening, we're going to have a fast car, you know, the real works, out the side entrance of the hotel. We're going to smuggle him out through the servants' entrance, and away we'd go. When we approached the hotel, actually Fred Stone was present with a couple of his cronies, pestering George because he never got a moment's peace. So we thought, well, there's only one thing to do. We've heard stories about George Adamski being telepathic, and he knew it was about the time we were due to come anyway. So we thought we'd concentrate. So we stood outside there like a lot of twits in the hall and said, "Come on, George, it's time you were kidnapped," sort of thing, mentally, jokingly. Anyway, the door opened and out came George. He said, "Yes." He said, "I realised you were here." He said, "I told old Fred I had an urgent call. I wanted to go to the bathroom." And we said, "Right, this is it." So we took him on either side and down the stairs and off. And I think that must have been the longest visit George ever made to the bathroom, because he never appeared that night again. And we had a wonderful evening for about 7 or 8 hours with him, talking on all sorts of subjects. And he really did tell us some things. He really opened up. And while a lot of the things he said were obviously rubbish, I mean, a lot of his scientific knowledge was zero, or less than zero, he did say certain things then that we thought were nonsense, which have later proved to be true. He did say, and this is most interesting, he said the moon has a soil, has got soil on it. Now, I might be mistaken, but I think this Russian probe has announced that there is a form of soil on the moon when it dug its probe in, and it's in fact full of microorganisms. So the moon is definitely alive and not dead. Secondly, of course, he said, as he did in Flying Saucer... not Flying Saucer of Land, the second book, Inside the Spaceships, he reported seeing fireflies in space. Colonel Glenn saw fireflies in space. Several things like this which are strange. But one thing he did tell us, and this is fairly significant, he told us that he'd received notification from his cosmic buddies that there were a group of rather negative types of space visitors, and they were coming from an area around Orion, around the Orion Nebula, as we understood it. And I thought, God, shades of George Hart Williamson. He said that they would be arriving in about a year, and to watch out for all sorts of monster stories, strange kidnappings, and all sorts of funny things happening. And he said, he stressed that these were not his friends at all. Well, that be that as it may, we sort of accepted that and said, well, fair enough, we'll wait and see. But it was most significant that about a year later, in 1960, in Sydney, I don't know whether Mr. Thomas knows about this case. I don't think he would. Now, we have, by the way, with us this evening, Mr. Andrew Thomas, who's the ex-editor of the Flying Saucer Review, the Australian Flying Saucer Review, a most excellent publication. And he will be saying a few words, we hope, after the coffee break. This concerned a milkman in 1960 in Sydney. I can never remember the... Do you remember the name of the beach, Lynn? Cronulla, yes. Cronulla Beach. He was delivering milk one morning, quite early, and suddenly he said he saw a pulsing light coming from behind a sandhill. He went round to investigate, and there was a disc-shaped object sitting on the ground. And there was a chap digging in the sand nearby, obviously taking samples or something. The chap got up, went over to the milkman and greeted him in perfect English, but with a slight trace of an accent, said, we've been expecting you to come here. We've got something to tell you. Said, we are part of a scientific expedition visiting the planet Earth at this time from a region of space you know as the Eta Carina region, which is towards the galactic centre. Now, this milkman is an ordinary chap that had relatively no scientific knowledge, and especially none of astronomy. He just repeated this verbatim, what he'd been told. They said that it had taken them about 3 years of flight to reach the Earth. They had some form of hyperdrive, they could go faster than light. And they said that they had to come through, because the space lanes, now I'm using language which everybody understands, they used a similar language that they knew that he would understand when he told, well, other people understand when he told the story. So they used space lanes that aren't straight. They said, contrary to what you might think, when you want to go from one point in the galaxy to another point in the galaxy, you don't go by a straight line. In fact, you go by a curved line, because space is curved. And that these special lanes have to be adhered to. Otherwise, you get in some sort of cross-magnetic galactic currents or such like, which cause trouble. And you can get lost very easily. They said, we had to come through an area near the nebula you know as M42 Orionis, which is the great nebula in Orion. They said, it is very dangerous coming through this area because there are a system of planets that have rather bad people on them. People that have advanced terrifically scientifically to the extent of being completely, well, almost ruled by computers. Their worlds are computerized to the nth degree. But they have no sort of spiritual awareness, and their whole purpose and plan is to further their empire and their aims, because they're becoming overcrowded. Shades of our own planet. We're becoming overcrowded. Everything is becoming computerized. Spiritual values are being lost. Very interesting parallel. And he said they are on the lookout for new planets. And the planet Earth at this time is very similar to their own system. And they have designs on it. He said, we have to return within a few weeks to our own home planet and report. So we are also working in close conjunction with other space entities which have been visiting your planet from nearby star systems to your own, including your own system. We said, when we have to return the same way as we came, and there is a chance that we may not return. We may get literally shot down by these characters if they find out we're travelling through their space lanes. So we will return in about, naturally, about 6 years. Now that was 1960. They should have been back about last year if they had followed their pattern. He said, we will contact you when we return. Now I'm waiting on some information from Sydney as to whether this chap has been contacted again. It would be most interesting to find out this information. Now this sounds like a science fiction story, I know. You can't prove it. The chap has no proof. But he is an ordinary milkman. I did visit his home, and very carefully, as all investigators should do when they visit homes of people who claim UFO sightings and landings, one should look at their bookcase. He had no... Well, he didn't even have a bookcase. No books. He just used to read the Sunday papers and the Sunday supplement, things like this. I mentioned George Adamski, and he said he'd heard of him from the papers but wasn't sure what it was all about. And prior to the visit with his contact in the Sandhills, he said that he hadn't even given flying saucers a thought. Thought they were all rubbish. He said he still wasn't sure whether they weren't all rubbish. He said I might have been hoaxed. And I think to this day he still doesn't know. Now, from that story, now I just told you that as an interest to follow up to George Adamski's telling us that in about a year's time there would be some rather negative types around. Now, while that milkman's landing wasn't a negative one, or apparently wasn't, they did report, or give the same report to him as George gave to us. After this, there's a slight gap. Not really much happened, but we have several cases, interesting cases, including the Father Gill, which I think is one of the most famous that Australasia has ever had. I don't know whether you can see this. That is an actual drawing of the craft that Father Gill saw, one with the four landing legs. And I have here an actual verbatim report from Father Gill. I'll quote. Personally, Father Gill was still sceptical. In his letter to the Reverend Dury, he wrote, "My simple mind still requires scientific evidence before I can accept the from outer space theory." This was before his sighting. He'd been told by this Reverend Dury. Reverend Dury had asked him about whether it was possible there were spacecraft in our skies. "I am inclined to think that many unidentified flying objects are more likely to be some kind of electric phenomena. I prefer to wait for some bright boy to catch one and exhibit it in Martin Place," that's in Sydney. Very shortly, however, Father Gill was to change his tune. On Friday, June 26, at about 6:45, he left his dinner table and walked out through the front door of the mission house to a small patch of lawn fringed by a few trees. 50 feet below was the shingled beach. Now, this was in New Guinea. Remember Keith Cartwright and his mental image of a craft in New Guinea. Glancing up at the sky in search of the planet Venus, a bright light caught his attention. Later he wrote, "I saw Venus, but I also saw this sparkling object, which to me was peculiar because it was very, very bright. It was above Venus, and so that caused me to watch it for a while. Then I saw it descend towards us." Shades of Wumerit telling people about planet Jupiter and Venus moving around. Two of the mission teachers had joined Father Gill. He had a notebook and a pencil in his pocket and begun to make hurried notes. The three men watched the light and appeared like a tilly lamp. I don't know, you know what a tilly lamp is? A camping lamp. But kept varying in brightness as though it were approaching and receding. Then the object came closer and seemed to hover at about 300 feet. It was circular, ran Father Gill's description. It had a wide base and narrower upper deck. Beneath it, there were what appeared to be a set of legs. At times, it produced a shaft of blue light that shone up into the sky at an angle of about 45 degrees. Then came the strangest sight of all. Just before 7 o'clock, Father Gill saw a man-like figure moving about the top of the object. Then this figure was joined by three others. Father Gill subsequently wrote, "As we watched it, men came out from this object and appeared on what seemed to be a deck on top of the huge disc. There were four men in all, but only occasionally were all in view at once. The object remained in view until 7:20 p.m., then the men disappeared inside and it moved off and was lost behind a cloud. Father Gill and his companions continued to watch, and at 8:29, another UFO, much smaller, was seen over the area. At 8:35, another was sighted over Wandabuna village and a third farther to the east. At 8:50, they saw a bigger craft. It was stationary over the sea, and they thought it could have been the original one on which they had sighted the men. The other UFOs kept coming and going through the clouds. As they descended, light was reflected from them like a huge, large halo onto cloud, and all of them were seen very clearly. By 9 o'clock, all the smaller craft had disappeared from sight, and 10 minutes later, Father Gill noted in his diary, "Mothership gone too, giving red light." Next day, Father Gill questioned the natives and mission staff and finally located 38 other persons beside himself who were ready to sign a document, testifying that they had seen what we assumed to be human activities or beings of some other sort or some sort on the object itself. I think that's one of the most startling cases ever to come out of Australasia. Father Gill, of course, definitely has no reason to make up a story like that. Of course, being an Anglican priest and a missionary as well. The objects were seen for quite some time after this over the area, New Guinea, and definitely seemed interested in the place. We have many, many landings. That sort of started a spate. From then on, after a short period of apparently nothing, lots of landings took place in Australia. We have a very good landing report by Mr. Dennis Crowe. This was in Vaucluse Beach, Sydney, at 5:30 p.m. on July the 19th, 1965. This is a more recent one. There is a sketch. You can see it's a bit small, but there is a sketch he drew of the craft, and he is an engineer. Many, many reliable people started to see the craft, see these craft coming down and taking off. And we plotted on a map. It was plotted on a map, actually, of landings. And here was the landing scene, or the Australian scene, 1963-64. I don't know whether you can see from back there, but here's Australia. These dots here represent the concentration of landings. Now, notice something very interesting. Here's where I come from, South Australia. Look at the concentration. Look. Sydney. Melbourne. You see, wherever there's a lot of people situated, concentrated, you get sightings. No sightings up here. No people. A few over here. Now, plotting these main reports, we came to the conclusion that they were in fact investigating fault lines and areas of magnetic disturbance. Now, note a terrific amount of sightings up here. Woomera Rocket Range. The site of the atomic bomb explosions at Maralinga. And so on and so on. And the latest, if I can find it, I think it's in this one. Yes. Here we have the Australian scene, 1965. 66. Again, large concentrations at the capital cities. Brisbane, Sydney, Melbourne, Adelaide, and now Perth. Up here in North Queensland, Cairns and Tully area. Now I'd like to just very briefly get onto this Tully business because it's most intriguing. And this is the famous case of the so-called flying saucer nests, which appeared in the local press here, but this story is much more sort of interesting as it's got a lot more detail in it. Took place in Tully in 1966. Last few months of 65. And there were these great, this George chap called George A. Pedley reported seeing an object in the flat marshy country. It came down the flat marshy country around Tully. It's a tropical area. And when he went to investigate afterwards, he found this area where a 30-foot circle of reeds. Now this was a marsh-covered water, watery marsh, and they discovered that he discovered with witnesses that the actual reeds had been literally plucked off the bottom of the pond and flung in a perfect circle. They tried all sorts of experiments up there, people, and they couldn't duplicate this effect. How could these reeds... It's almost as if some great suction force had sucked the reeds up and then they'd been spun in some sort of force field. I'll just read you a bit here. The nest was a perfectly circular clearing of 30-foot diameter. It consisted of a 9-inch layer of reeds torn out by the roots from the muddy bed of the lagoon. It was floating on the top of 5 feet of water, and all the reeds were swirled in a clockwise direction. The flattened area was surrounded by healthy, upright green reeds 2.5 feet tall. The underwater examination showed that the lagoon floor was perfectly smooth, with all roots cleanly removed, as though pulled out by some great sucking force. And they found later lots of others around the same area, substantiated by reports of people seeing objects taking off. Scientists sort of descended on the place in great detail and, of course, came up with all sorts of the usual conflicting theories, which I won't bore you with at the moment. Now, the final two cases I'm going to deal with, I've already spoken about here before. We have two interesting cases, two of which I've spoken about before, and this was the famous Plimpton landing, the two small boys who saw the object come down in Adelaide. And I'll just very briefly read you, this is a very short report in the Australian Flying Saucer Review, called Landing of a Spaceship or Fantasy. A fantastic report comes from two South Australian boys, David and Ken, whose full names and addresses are known to the editor. Shortly after 2 o'clock in the afternoon on Saturday, February the 29th, 1964, David, walking through the front gate of his house, heard a buzzing noise which emanated from the paddock across the street. He went there and saw a metallic craft with glass dome surmounted by a light, sitting on the ground. As David watched in amazement, recalling flying saucers he'd seen on television, a sliding door went straight up and a very tall figure appeared in the opening. a man wore a tight black suit, a blue cloak, black gloves and some letters, silver chains on his wrists, a pointed hat or helmet flat at the bottom, shiny black boots which appeared to be made of metal, black thick belt with a buckle. The face of the pilot was coppery red and the nose large. Inside the craft was another man in a sitting position looking through the glass dome. He seemed to be dressed in the same uniform as the figure in the doorway. The pilot stepped out of the ship and began to look around. Without revealing his presence, David raced up to the home of his friend Ken. In a minute or two, both boys were on the site. When the strangely dressed man from the craft saw the children, he ran back into it as if alarmed. The trap door closed, the craft took off gently, gradually ascending straight up into the sky at high speed. A dog nearby barked desperately during the incident. The two boys pointed out later that the soft buzzing noise issued from the engine of the craft. They went home and told David's mother about the experience, but the lady, quite unimpressed, told the boys to keep quiet and not scare the younger child in the room. It must not be overlooked. The boys are small, 6 to 8 years. Although reminiscent of science fiction, David's story is quite coherent. Though shaken by the encounter with the strange craft and its pilots, the two small boys were sufficiently observant and intelligent to remember its shape and appearance of the odd-looking men. The report is very journalistic and not quite accurate, I'm happy to say. Myself and another chappie went and investigated this story immediately it happened, within a day actually, on the Sunday. This took place on a Saturday. And basically that's correct, except the boys didn't tell the reporter of this report that the chap was playing with some studs on his belt all the time he was walking forward. And also that he had a tube that ran out of one glove and up under one nostril. And that he was about we later estimated him to be about 7 foot tall. And he was making his way towards a small creek which runs by this paddock. And we later discovered on the map at the university that this creek, in fact, it follows a fault line. Now, what wasn't mentioned in here was the fact that a chap had been digging his garden. Now, there's some houses that face on this field, and this chap had been digging his garden. He said about 10 minutes before this alleged landing took place, he had an uncontrollable urge to go and make a cup of tea in the back room. He did this, and he said after he'd drunk his tea and came out, of course, the whole thing was over. And I thought, that's very convenient. And quite frankly, at the time, we were very sceptical about this, because this character here looks a bit like Superman or Batman or somebody, which Batman, by the way, was running at that time in Australia. No. Oh, well, no. Was one of those strange characters. And we thought, oh, well, perhaps these boys are making things up. But we couldn't break their story down, and neither could the police. The police kept at them for some time. And then, substantiated even further, about 30 or 40 separate people living nearby reported that on that afternoon they had seen a strange saucer-shaped craft disappear at an angle into the sky. So we thought, maybe there's something in it. Then came the collaboration, another landing, if you like, that sort of pointed this the fact that this story could be quite true. And this took place up in the north of South Australia in a small farm. And the woman on the farm had been getting all sorts of strange experiences, which I won't go into now because they're mostly of a psychic nature, which, of course, is unprovable in any shape or form. We just don't know about psychic phenomena. But we certainly know about the object that landed in her front garden. About 2 o'clock in the morning, an object hovered in her front garden, shone a beam of light in through the window, which woke her and her husband. Now, her husband's a very hard-headed chappie, a real wheat farmer. Before this, he thought that his wife was going bonkers, even to the stage of sending her to the local psychiatrist in Adelaide. And actually, the psychiatrist turned out to be a UFO addict, so that didn't prove anything. But after this case, after this time, he became a firm believer himself in the whole subject. This object hovered in the front garden. It was a disc-shaped object about 30 foot in diameter. And it was lighting up the garden with an intense white light. And as she, as her eyes became accustomed to the light, she noticed that there was a character standing in the garden, holding a box-like contraption in front of his face and apparently taking photographs or readings or something of all the plants. He'd point the object at the plants, there'd be a slight click, and that would be that. He then swung around and saw her, pointed the object at her. She thought her last days had suddenly come. It went buzz, click, no effect. Then he quite casually turned around and walked away. Suddenly, the bright light from the craft overhead went out. Now, naturally, as you can imagine, with this intense white light, and suddenly it going out, of course, the woman concerned was completely blinded for some time. Not to mention astounded. And when she looked, this craft, when she finally regained her sight, the craft had gone, and the occupant had gone. She did go out in the garden, and she did in fact find footprints. Now, her description, this is what I'm coming to, her description of the chappie was almost identical to the two young lads' description. Now, the two people could not have collaborated with each other in any way, shape or form, because Mrs. Player's case took place before the landing at Plympton, about 3 weeks before. And of course, all this was kept completely secret. It was only known to about four people, myself included, about Mrs. Player. That's the farmer's wife. So here we have an excellent case of two landings, completely apparently unrelated, but with the same character, dressed identically. She said the thing that struck her was the coppery red colour of his face and his big nose. I quote, "The face of the pilot was coppery red and his nose large." So, we had to think twice about the two young boys and their sighting of Batman. A very, very interesting and intriguing case, the two of them. And especially the fact about, and the young boys, about the fault line. And there was one other thing that happened. Two young lads found, about 2 days later, found a great hole, a completely square hole had been cut in the bank of this creek. Now, I went and saw this hole, and I assure you that it couldn't have been done with a human shovel. It would have to have been done by some form of square die that would move into the bank, cut straight into it, and remove a great chunk of earth. Now, had in fact this craft been there before, early in the morning perhaps, and taking samples, who knows? Well, I was going to tell you about Arnhem Land and all sorts of funny things that happened up there, but I see that time is running short, so I'll have to leave that to another time. But I will briefly tell you about the case that took place just before I left Australia on the tracking station in Darwin. Now, I actually took part in this as it was happening. And I can release this information now because the security has been lifted on this case. It was classified as secret, but has now been released. We were engaged in Doppler tracking of satellites. I won't go into the technicalities of it. And we had a teleprinter link with NASA headquarters in the States. In fact, there's a NASA network right throughout the world. And we were in contact via the Adelaide Center, NASA Center, Communication Center, with both Woomera and the new tracking station at Carnarvon in Western Australia. That's the station which is now tracking the latest men in space, the Project Gemini and the next Project Apollo. This was about 9 o'clock at night. We'd just finished tracking a satellite pass and the teleprinter went crazy. There was an urgent message from Carnarvon to us. Now, they had just installed their latest radar, their latest ground-to-space radar system, which has an 80-foot diameter dish and runs umpteen megawatts of peak power and can literally pinpoint an object the size of a basketball in space at 10,000 kilometers range. This is a fantastic piece of equipment. And they were trying this out. And they said, we have an unidentified bogey approaching the Earth. They said, don't laugh, at 50,000 kilometers per hour. So we think that they first of all thought the radar was off, wasn't working properly. They were picking up some scatter reflection or something. But it turned out the object was completely solid. They said, we've fed the coordinates into our computer and we've computed that the track will take it over Darwin in approximately 5 minutes. So we rushed out. We immediately rang the RAF station at Darwin. They had their radar scanning, their close-range radar, the long-range radar scanning. I rushed outside, and unfortunately we missed it, but the RAF station at Darwin didn't. They saw it. It went overhead at a fantastic speed. They said it was like a great fireball trailing sparks, but definitely circular in shape. And a pilot officer of some many hours flying time said it was like nothing he'd seen before. He said, and as it went over the station, it changed course. It executed almost a 90-degree turn. Now, no meteorite does this. And they said, we got severe interference to our radar system. They picked up the object on the radar as it approached, but they said even before the radar could sweep round for its next sweep and take the next reading on it, said the radar was just literally full of snow. A terrific interference. All communication systems stopped on the RAF station. Terrific interference on the radio systems. I noticed our Doppler tracking receivers were going crazy. And then suddenly righted itself as the object went. Evidently, we were a fraction too late. We came out of our tracking station just as the object was sort of going over the horizon, and we missed it. About half an hour later, a courting couple on the cliffs of Nightcliff in Darwin reported that they were watching a V formation of coloured lights executing manoeuvres over the sea, and they wondered if this was the Indonesian invasion, which at that time was imminent, so people thought. And they rang us, and in fact, objects were seen over the sea. And that started a whole series of UFO reports and Darwin sightings, which I won't go into now, including a submarine one, which an object that came out of the sea and heated up the sea. Terrific, great UFO sighting. In fact, so much so that the RAF up there got so worried, they sent out Neptune bombers to search the ocean to see what was going on. They thought they'd better defend the cliff, defend our station, so they brought up a 3.5-inch field gun. I don't know what this was going to do. Well, I haven't got time, unfortunately, to go into all sorts of things about old ancient cave paintings and reports of UFOs by natives up in the Northern Territory and ancient places where they've been seen for thousands of years. So I will close now. I hope that's been an interesting rundown on what's happened up to date in Australia. As you can see, they've had quite a good deal of landings and fairly spectacular sightings, and I'm sure these will go on. Unfortunately for England, of course, the population being so dense, I don't think that England is going to have the quantity of these landings. Thank you very much.